طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Lately, the feature presentations on This Week in Palestine have been lengthy, and we have not been able to report some of the significant new successes of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But there has been one success that cannot go unmentioned, as reported in the following article in Mondo Weiss. British security company G4S, the world's largest, has responded to a four-year-long global BDS campaign protesting its role in Israeli violations of Palestinian human rights by announcing that it will sell its Israeli subsidiary in the coming 12 to 24 months. In describing the move, the Financial Times reported that G4S was extracting itself from reputationally damaging work. Since 2010, G4S has lost contracts worth millions of dollars in many countries following BDS pressure to end its complicity in Israeli prisons, where Palestinians are tortured and held without trial, as well as in Israeli checkpoints, settlements, and a police training center. Their lost clients include private businesses, universities, trade unions, and UN bodies. The Bill Gates Foundation in 2014 divested its $170 million stake in the company following protests at its offices in Seattle, London, and Johannesburg. In recent weeks, UNICEF in Jordan and a major restaurant chain in Colombia became the latest high-profile bodies to end their contracts with G4S following BDS campaigns. As the height of the international boycott of apartheid South Africa, BDS pressure is making some of the world's largest corporations realize that profiting from Israeli apartheid and colonialism is bad for business, said Mahmoud Nawaja, a spokesperson for the Palestinian BDS National Committee, the broadest coalition in Palestinian society that leads the BDS movement. Investment fund managers are increasingly recognizing that their fiduciary responsibility obliges them to divest from Israeli banks and companies that are implicated in Israel's serious human rights violations, such as G4S and Hewlett-Packard, because of the high risk entailed. We are starting to notice a domino effect, he added. French multinationals Veolia and Orange and CRH, Ireland's biggest company, have all exited the Israeli market in recent months, mainly as a result of BDS campaigning. United Methodist Church has put five Israeli banks on a blacklist due to their complicity in human rights violations, including the financing of illegal Israeli settlements. Palestinian lawyer Sahar Francis, director of Adamir Prison Support and Human Rights Association, commented, "We are grateful to all of the dedicated grassroots organizers around the world who are working in solidarity with Palestinians seeking freedom, justice, and equality. But G4S is infamous for breaking pledges to end its participation in Israeli crimes. Our boycott of G4S will remain among the BDS movement's top priorities until we actually see it back out of the door of Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. We also welcome the news that G4S is also selling its business that operate youth detention centers in the U.S. and the U.K., both of which have seen G4S targeted by campaigners over its abusive practices, and both of which are part of deeply racist incarceration systems. From the U.S. to Palestine, from South Africa to the U.K., G4S is deeply involved in racist mass incarceration business. We remain determined to work closely with partners to hold G4S to account for its participation in human rights abuses. G4S also has a long and documented track record of participation in human rights and workers' rights abuses elsewhere in the world, especially in prisons and migrant detention centers it has run in the U.S., the U.K., and South Africa. Now would you add it? Failing to stop the impressive growth of BDS in pursuit of freedom and justice, Israel is desperately trying to smear and delegitimize our nonviolent movement, including with anti-democratic laws in Europe and the U.S. aimed at silencing dissent and suppressing our freedom of speech. We believe strongly that our ethical approach and just cause will prevail, as this latest G4S announcement shows. In September 2015, French corporate giant Veolia sold off all its businesses in Israel. This was a direct result of a 7-year campaign against its role in infrastructure projects for illegal settlements in Israel that cost more than $20 billion in lost tenders and contracts. A leading French-based Israeli business recently told the Israeli media that the growing strength of the BDS movement means that most major European companies now avoid investing in Israel. Foreign direct investment in Israel dropped by 46% in 2014 as compared to 2013, according to a UN report, partially due to the impressive growth of the BDS impact, as stated by one of the report's authors. That was an article from the news service Mondelweiss. So now we know why Israel is investing so much time, energy, and money fighting the BDS movement, including a state-by-state stealth campaign to develop legislation opposing BDS here in the United States. It is beginning to cost them money, big time, and they are lashing back. This morning our feature presentation is by Nadia Ben-Youssef, the U.S. representative of the human rights organization and legal center, Adala. Adala means justice in Arabic and is based in Haifa. She speaks about the attempts of Adala to save a Bedouin village in the Negev of Israel, a village named al-Haran, which has been in existence since the early 1950s. Now Israel has decided to level al-Haran to build a much larger, exclusively Jewish town that will be named just Haran. The Negev is huge and mostly unpopulated, yet Israel continues its purging of Bedouin villages by choosing this particular site for a new Jewish town rather than building on much available vacant space. Nadia Ben-Youssef's presentation refers occasionally to PowerPoint images, which obviously cannot be seen by our radio audience, but most of these images simply illustrate how the new Jewish town will replace the village of al-Haran and are not central to her compelling narrative. Nadia gave this presentation at Tufts University. She's introduced by Tufts anthropology professor Amal Bishara.
Okay, I want to thank all of you for being here today, and I also want to especially thank Nadia Ben Youssef for being here today. She's just back from Palestine, and you, like, not 48 hours, right?
Right.
And I think that really we've all been, and those of us who've been following the story of Umm al-Hayran have been in shock since the new court case came out that after 13 years of legal struggle, this community of 1,000 people is really facing immediate displacement and demolition of their community. And you're going to hear a lot more about that, obviously, from Nadia Ben Youssef. So I'm just going to give you a little introduction to her. Since 2010, Nadia has been working with Adala, which is one of the most preeminent human rights organizations in Israel, Palestinian human rights organizations as well. And one of the big cases that they have taken on is that of the Bedouin community in the Naqab, and it's been a specialty of yours, as I understand. She, before working at Adala, she's worked on human rights violations in India. She's served as a speechwriter and legal assistant to Ms. Sherry Blair, and she's also worked as a civil litigator for indigent clients in the area here, in the Boston community. She also speaks fluent French and Spanish and Arabic. She, for those of you who are thinking about pursuing careers in human rights law, I think this is a great opportunity for you to talk to somebody who's done it so beautifully and so successfully. She got her law degree from Boston College with a certificate in human rights and international justice. And now in the United States, she's been doing a lot of really fascinating and important solidarity work with a lot of different communities, Arab-American communities, African-American communities, Jewish communities, and others. She publishes in The Nation, Huffington Post, among other places. And I've just been delighted that we kind of fortuitously have you as part of the Boston community. Adela's work is moving at a vital, vital importance, and so having you here in the community to bring that here and also augment it with everything else you're doing that's not just, you know, sort of revolving around Adela is a tremendous gift. So, and again, I mean, some of you probably heard about Naqab and Umm al-Hayran last year when Suhad Bishara of Adela presented. And I just find that, frankly, we should, as a community with resources and specialty and concern with this area, it's a good commitment for us to say we're going to keep following this case. We're going to know what's going on and we're going to do what we can because this is a really, really urgent case. So thank you for presenting this update and this talk on Umm al-Hayran versus head-on.
Thank you so much. So thank you so much, Aman. thank you so much for being here and spending your free block with us and being concerned about this case, learning about what's going on, and seeing how we can work together. And in fact, it's a really good opportunity for me to dialogue a bit with you because we've kind of reached the end of the road in many ways. In terms of the legal work that we can do to save this village. So a lot of that is now turning, and we've had an advocacy strategy to coincide, which is the way that Adala does its work. But this is a hard story to tell. For some reason, it's a really hard story to tell. It seems very clear what's going on. It seems pretty, and I think the issue is that it's so clear that it actually seems absurd. That the case actually seems absurd. So what I'm going to do is tell you a bit about the Naqab generally, just to give a bit of background, and then we're going to go right into this case. And I'll give you legal updates, what the Supreme Court of Israel has said, and also what the community is gearing up to do, and how then maybe to think about what mobilizing here could look like. I'm interested. I have a notebook next to me. I want to hear your ideas. I want to think with you about what resonates with you as Americans, as students, as people who care about these issues, who care about social justice, so that we can maybe tailor our messaging in such a way that will be more effective. It's a devastating case. We were shocked, in fact, and it's hard to be shocked in Palestine, but we were shocked by the decision. So I'll run through this a little bit, and then hopefully, if there's something to interrupt me a bit, please feel free, and thank you again for having me. So, in fact, though, should I say, you said something about Adela, so this is good. We're going to talk about the Naqab. So this little map, put a little red square around it. The Naqab is about 60% of the land of Israel, so it's in the south, 60% of the land, 10% of Israelis live here, so it's sparsely populated. Not very many people live in the Naqab, but about 32% are Palestinian Bedouin. So just a broad overview of the demographics in Israel so that we can be clear, one in five Israelis is a Palestinian. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. 20% of the population of Israel. Palestinians who remained in their homeland after the Nakba, after the catastrophe, after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and became a homeland minority, essentially. So they became citizens, all Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the state was established, became citizens in 1952, became full Israeli citizens in 1952, but lived under a military regime until 1966. And this is an interesting date if people are following dates and can think about connections. 1966, of course, you have the occupation begins in 1967. So just where we're talking about. So in the Nakab, 32% of the population is Palestinian Bedouin. And they live now about number around 200,000 people. 200,000 people. 100,000 Palestinian Bedouin citizens of Israel live in what are called unrecognized villages. There are 35 unrecognized villages in the Nakab. And what that means, what does that mean? Also, I think this is like where this starts becoming crazy and difficult to comprehend. Unrecognized villages. Unrecognized by whom? Here's a map. Here are villages. But this is not a map of the state. This is a map by the Regional Council of the Unrecognized Villages, an organization in the Nakab. Because these villages don't exist on any maps. On any maps, if you look at a map of the State of Israel, you're not going to see any of these 35 unrecognized villages. And these villages either predated the establishment of the state, so they were already here in this area, in the Nakab, before the state was established in 1948, or, and this is the case of Umm el-Hiran, or were created by military order when the military government of Israel concentrated the Bedouin community into a smaller area in the Nakab. They concentrated them and moved them away from their ancestral land. So when we're going to be talking about Umm el-Hiran here, their ancestral land is near Gaza, and they were moved here in 1956 by military order. None of that is disputed, and it becomes a really important issue in the case. Because what the state says, despite the fact that most of these villages predated the establishment of the state says, and this is really interesting, and if you're interested in law and you're interested in understanding law not as a powerful tool but as a tool of the powerful, you might find this very compelling, because legally, all of the Palestinian Bedouins are trespassers on state land. After the state was established, all of the land of the Nakab became state land. So the people who were there, even if they were there before the law suddenly declared this as state land, became trespassers. Became trespassers on state land. So their villages became illegal under Israeli law. And so they are not on any maps. They're disconnected from any basic services. No water, no electricity, no sewage, no roads, no schools, no health clinics. And these are citizens of Israel. So maybe you're thinking, what does citizenship mean? And you would be right to think that. What is the law? You would be right to think that. This is so absurd, which is why it's hard to tell this story. This is Umm el-Hiran. Umm el-Hiran. And I'm going to talk about Umm el-Hiran and Atiyeh. So the name is the name that we said for the talk is Umm el-Hiran versus Hiran. And we use that because it's really quite striking. But these are twin villages. Atiyeh and Umm el-Hiran, if you go back to this map, they're really close to each other, Atiyeh and Umm el-Hiran, and they're from the same family, the Abu el-Qiyan family, who came from the Gaza Strip, and they settled right next to each other, but in two areas, across about 7,000 dunams, four dunams to an acre, you know, just a fit, I don't know, across this area. So Atiyeh and Umm el-Hiran. But this is the village of Hiran. Now we have about 1,000 people who live in Atiyeh and Umm el-Hiran, into these two twin villages. In 2003, in 2003.
The Israeli government issued home demolition orders on all of the villages, in all of the houses of the village, an eviction lawsuit against the residents of Atir Umhiran, and declared the houses illegal, and started preparing a plan for the village, the new town, the new settlement of Hiran. The name of the Palestinian Bedouin village is Umhiran. The name of this new Jewish town, established by the state, is called Hiran. This is from the master plan of Hiran, which is going to be was originally declared in 2003 when this was first proposed, or 2007 when it was first proposed, as an exclusively Jewish town. Exclusively Jewish town. And in fact, that can happen in the state of Israel. There can be exclusively X towns. 43% of all towns in Israel are run by, and these are small towns, so the issue is that this became a bit of a bigger town, so they can't really do exactly what they want. It's going to be about 2,000 people. But small communities in Israel can be governed by what are called admissions committees. Admissions committees are groups of five citizens. One has to be a member of the Jewish Agency, the other has to be a member of the World Zionist Organization, and these committees can decide who can enter or not into that town on the basis of the criteria, which was green-lighted by the Supreme Court of Israel. The criteria is on the basis of social suitability, whether or not someone is socially suitable to live in that town. So when this was first announced in 2007, we thought it would be governed by admissions committees that could say, this is an exclusively Jewish town. Now, because it's a larger village, and because there's been some negative press around this idea, the state is no longer saying this is exclusively Jewish, but the Supreme Court has acknowledged that it's going to be majority Jewish, and the residents, who we'll meet very soon, are actually ideological settlers originally from the West Bank, who are coming into Hiran. So this is the map of Hiran, and you'll notice here is Umhiran in the purple, and it's basically right on top, right where there's going to be a residential area. So Hiran is mapped out exactly on Umhiran.
Can I ask a quick question?
Please.
About the map there. The purple, you all didn't add that in. It's actually in their official map?
Yeah. So standing houses to be demolished. It's in their map.
It's in their map. Yeah.
And they're like, I don't know. There's some homes here. And can I... Here's a pause. I'm telling you, it's so absurd. 2012, I was at the Southern District Planning Committee in Beersheba, in the south of Israel. And we're there discussing Hiran. And the lead planner, the lead urban planner for this village of Hiran was there. He's from Tel Aviv. And he was there, and he was with his team. And we were, so in the, you're in the interior ministry, so you can't use like cameras or recorders or anything. This dude was taking pictures of our dear colleague, Suhad Bishara, who's the lead lawyer on the case, taking pictures of her and like watching her speak. And she was telling the story of Umhiran. And so I was like so upset that this was happening. And after this hearing, and I'm telling you this just because It makes this look... Anyway, the guy comes up to Suhad, and he's like, I had no idea. I had no idea about this case. I've never been to this area. And when I looked on a map, there is no such thing as Umhiran. And when I looked at our plan, it was just these standing structures to be demolished. So he was shocked, which I just find so tragic. So tragic. But the rest of the team had been there, they knew about it, and they went forward anyway. Does anyone read Hebrew in this class? Here's where it gets even crazier. It says Hiran. What's happening here is in 2014, we're preparing for the Supreme Court decision, and we're in the village, and there had been rumors for about 2 years that the settlers who were going to live in Umhiran were already there, living in a nearby forest, waiting for the demolition of the village. And we asked the residents of Umm al-Hiran, like, have you seen them? And they said, no, like, I mean, we did, like, a 2-kilometer radius. Like, I don't know. There's no settlers. We were taking affidavits from the community for the Supreme Court hearing. Oh, Lord. And Ali Aboulghian comes rushing in to Suhad, and he's like, I found them. We found them. And she was like, what? And Suhad got in the Jeep. It was night. And she got in the Jeep, and she came back, and she was shaking. She was like, you would not believe what I saw. They're there. They're waiting. And we were like, what? Crazy. So the next day, I went as, like, an undercover journalist. I was terrible. But this is what we saw. This is what's in the middle of the forest, in Yatir Forest. But it's on the 48, on the Israeli side of the Green Line. All this, again, is happening inside Israel. You go, and there's a big military gate, and you have a proper community. A proper community, there's electricity, there's water, there's recycling services, and there's this amazing bus stop, that in Hebrew says it's the Regional Council of Mount Hebron. What? Hebron, in the West Bank. The Regional Council of Mount Hebron. Hebron is a very important and vicious settlement of Jewish Israelis who live there. So it's very interesting what's happening. Just for Americans, I think this is important. This mobile home was made possible through the generosity of JNF USA and its commitment to Blueprint Negev. JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is one of the premier Jewish institutions in the world, and it's usually known for afforestation plans. I'm not sure why I put this here, but essentially, it's to remind us again of the. No, I don't know. Maybe it's to show you where we are. This is Yatir Umm al-Hiran. This is Lev Yatir. This is where the settlement is located. I want to show you a video if I can, and then we'll move quickly. I hope. Is this okay? Interesting. So we made this video when we went to see. So Adana has represented Yatir Umm al-Hiran, the two villages, through the entire legal system in Israel. And in May of 2015, the Supreme Court said, go ahead, to the state, it's fine. Any attempts that we had made to cancel the eviction orders, to cancel the home demolition orders were denied. And amazingly, the court says this is not the address for creating chaos. So don't bring us this case. What's interesting here is, Lord, what's not interesting here? The major way that we can use the legal system in Israel, particularly with regard to the Bedouin, the facts that we'll use in order to challenge demolition orders or eviction lawsuits, we have to deal with two primary arguments of the state, which I mentioned at the beginning, that they're trespassers. The Bedouin are trespassers, so they're lawbreakers according to the laws of Israel. So we're not going to do anything exceptional to help you out. You're a trespasser. The second is that this land where you are, Bedouin, and this is kind of it's a very interesting argument, is not suitable for residential use. So even if we wanted you to stay there, and maybe we do, it's not good for you. It's not good for you, Bedouin, so you need to leave. This case, Adala was able to prove through archives, military documents, exactly what I said, so that the military moved these people here in 1956 and gave them the 7,000 dunams of land. So they weren't trespassers, and the court had to accept it. And the court did accept it. And as to the second argument, that this is not suitable for residential use, the plan of Hiran disproves that pretty easily. In fact, it is a beautifully suitable place for residential use if you're the right kind of resident. So in the decision, basically the court said, and this was a 2-1 decision, so there's 15 justices on the Supreme Court. Oftentimes in cases like this, you would think you would have an expanded panel to address this pretty clearly discriminatory policy of demolishing one village because the residents are Palestinian or Bedouin and replacing it with a Jewish community. They didn't get to that issue. Even the dissenting judge didn't get to that issue. She said, you know, she thought maybe that the Bedouin might have some rights, but nonetheless, it's not about discrimination. They said, listen, okay, you're not trespassers. We did give you the land, but it's public land, so we can take it back. We can take it back. So they said, it's ours. We can do with it what we would. And alternatives exist. So what does that mean? The plan of the state for the Bedouin is to move them into a nearby town. It's a township called Houra. So in the Naqab, I remember there was 200,000 people, 100,000 live in unrecognized villages. The other 100,000 live in either what are called recently recognized villages, these are villages that since 2003 have been recognized by the state, or government planned towns. There are 7 government planned towns, and they are the poorest in Israel, highest rates of crime, of poverty, no industry. It reminds me in many ways of a kind of a reservation policy. These are towns where you drive through them and you're like, what is this? Like, this doesn't look like any other town that I know. And so these towns, there are 7 of them. Houra is one of them. The plan is to move them to Houra. So they said, listen, there's an alternative. You can go. And that was the decision of the Supreme Court. We requested a second hearing in July. One, for the expanded panel that I mentioned, to have more people look at this case. And 2, asking, because it's an extraordinary decision, to demolish an entire village, displace 1,000 people in order to create the town of Hiran. And I haven't spoken about it much, but in Atir, the plan is to level the village of Atir, which is nearby, and to expand the Yatir forest. So it'll be expanded forest and grazing land for Hiran. This line, I think, in January is difficult to read, and it's more difficult because of the next slide I'm going to show you. In the court said, this case is not one that can be considered to be exceptionally exceptional, the rarest of rare, to warrant another hearing. And they denied our hearing, our request. I just want to, this, we haven't released this yet, we're releasing it today. And I'll tell you why and what's happening on the ground. But as we were kind of racking our brains after this decision, looking at Supreme Court precedents, we went back like 2 months to August. So the case was in May. The original decision was in May. In August, 3 months later, the Supreme Court issued this crazy decision. So we made this infographic in the last week called the Zeltzers versus Atir Umanira. So the story of the Zeltzers is a family of 5 that live near Jerusalem. And there's a plan to they have state permission to live here. They were given permission. And the plan around Jerusalem is to expand a forest, so another afforestation plan. And it would be over their home. So they lived there since 1974. They have permission to live there, and now there's a new plan. This is a family of 5. And they went to the Supreme Court, similar process, you know, challenging the plan. Then they went to the Supreme Court to say, this is an except to, you know, the how dare you state. And this is the line that was used by the Israeli Supreme Court in August of 2015. This case before us is a very special and unique case. And the court decided the family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The implications of this decision are huge. There are, again, 35 unrecognized villages. Basically, what the Supreme Court has said is, I mean, this is our strongest case in the Naqab. Adala does what's called impact litigation. So we look for the strongest case that's going to have a wide impact on a lot of people. Or we're taking cases that challenge large policies. So we are really strategic about the cases that we choose, and we're really cautious about land cases in Israel, because land and citizenship are the foundational issues of the state, and the state really can't let go of its control over those two kind of realms of the polity. So we took this case specifically. They're not trespassers. They were moved here by the state. This is a clearly discriminatory plan. Jewish citizen versus Palestinian citizen. Jewish privilege. Very, very clearly laid out. So we were shocked to lose this case, really. And often, like again, we're not usually that shocked because it's a disaster. And we're using essentially a colonial legal regime. And how do you use the law of the oppressor to protect the rights of the oppressed? It's very difficult, and we know that. But we took this case because we thought we could win. We didn't win. And so there are 35 unrecognized villages throughout the Naqab, 70,000 people who live there. There's a green light precedent to demolish all of those villages, which is just insane. It's insane, but it's not out of the ordinary, and it's not even out of Israel's intentions. In 2011, they passed this Proverb plan. I don't know if anyone heard of this Proverb plan. It was basically a large government plan to do exactly that, to demolish all of the 35 unrecognized villages and concentrate the Bedouin into those townships, the seven townships or the recently recognized towns. And we fought that mostly like through community mobilization, organizing, challenging the plan, and it was shelved in December of 2013. It was shelved. So the Supreme Court steps in and says, I'll give you a way to do that. I don't know if this is... I mean, basically, it's pretty clear, but this case, we also raised this in the January case because in the request for an exceptional hearing, if anyone is familiar with the disengagement plan of 2005, taking Israeli settlers out of the Gaza Strip, those settlers were there, again, illegally. Settlements are illegal under international law. They were there illegally. They were disengaged, this big disengagement from Gaza. And they went to the Supreme Court to say, oh, this is a violation of our constitutional rights to property and dignity. And the Supreme Court said, you know, right, you're right. Yes, this is a violation of dignity to lose your land in this way. And you should be compensated justly. So we brought that to the court. No constitutional rights were violated. If you're a Palestinian, your constitutional rights are conditional. Your constitutional rights are conditional, so are they meaningful at all? Again, you know, the alternatives, the compensation, the alternatives are for the people of Umm al-Hiran to move into Hura. Recently, the mayor of Hura, this government township, said, we can't take you in. We can't take, even if we wanted to take you in, and we don't want to because we want the Bedouin to be able to stay with dignity on their land. But even if we wanted to, we can't take you in. So the alternatives, which is a case that we brought in successfully, actually, one of the most only successful cases in the Naqab, in 2011, a village called Al-Sira. And Al-Sira was meant to be demolished. We went to the court, got to the district court, and they said, there's no suitable alternative, so you can't just demolish this village of 350 people. So we've been able to challenge that alternative discourse, but again, not here. Tomorrow, on the ground, there's a mass demolition. No.
Lord.
Freud, disaster demonstration. There's a mass demonstration planned on the ground. It's called Not Leaving. And basically, that's all that's left. And we are now in the process of kind of pushing for international action and trying to see if we can somehow pressure the state from international voices. So we'll be doing a lot, and we have been, which is what makes this pretty exhausting, at the UN, at the EU, in the United States. But we need to do a bit more, and we can do a bit more. And ultimately, you have to believe, and I do believe, that this is where it matters. The courts are one tool. The law is one tool, absolutely. But it's not the only tool. and the people of Umm al-Hiran also believe that the law is not the only tool, which is why they're continuing to mobilize. These are some of the calls that we're putting forward to the international community. And I'm interested now, I mean, I think I'll stop to hear your reactions. Again, I'm taking notes because I think we're in a bit of a disaster situation. And not to be so dramatic, Palestine is not generally a very disaster-free zone. But it is really, really important. And it's important to find a way to distill this story within your communities, within your schools, within your places of worship, distill this community to its essence, and to really consider the fact that we're going to allow this to happen, that this happens on our watch, that we are supportive or we are accepting of a state that says, if you're a certain kind of person, you have rights. If you're not a certain kind of person, you don't. And do we accept that? Do we accept that? And I know we don't, and I know that you don't. I know you're here for a specific reason. But this is a test case, not on Israel, not for Palestinians, but for all of us. It's a test case. So thank you so much for listening, and I'm interested in your reactions. Thank you.
That was a presentation by Nadia Ben Youssef of the human rights organization Adala, speaking about the systematic suppression of the Bedouin people in the Israeli Negev. And finally, before we wrap it up this week, I want to play a quick interview of an amazing Palestinian journalist, author, and playwright, Rula Jubril, conducted by Max Blumenthal. The interview took place before the conference at the National Press Club organized by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, parts of which we hope to feature on This Week in Palestine in the future. Rula Jubril speaks about the AIPAC conference, the Arab Spring, and the bias of the U.S. media. It is only 3 minutes long, but it is a gem.
You know, Monday you have this big event with AIPAC is basically dismantling the principle of democracy because they're waging, you know, a war on diversity. But basically what they are saying, we can buy whatever we want. Your policies belong to us.
Where are we now? Because a few years ago we were so hopeful about the Arab Spring maybe leading to Jerusalem.
My hope is not from the Arab nation somehow. The main actor in aborting the Arab Spring was Saudi Arabia, who financed every coup in the region because they were so concerned that the arrival of democratic system will reach Jeddah and Riyadh and people will start demanding more inclusive and negotiated system. Look, it took the American Constitution to be ratified 7 years until the Battle of Yorktown. I don't know how long it will take the Arab nations to become more inclusive, but I think now there's something that happened with the Iran deal that will force the region, and they produce no stability, Saudi Arabia. It's only a liability. It's time to break that bond.
Now, you've seen it from the inside. We met when you were driven off of MSNBC for pointing out that U.S. media is biased towards Israel. It seems obvious. It's like saying water's wet and the sky is blue and Judas told the Romans where Jesus slept. A CNN executive admitted that he helped write Netanyahu's speech to Congress.
Exactly. And then when I'm invited in CNN or in any other network, they always call me very worried. So what are you going to talk about? What are you... And they are so worried to tell the audience the truth about what's going on because they know that this will lead to shift in public opinion. But because of people like yourself, because of Alternate, it's because of Salon, it's because of Intercept, it's because of MondoWise, it's because of these amazing...
Electronic Intifada
and Ali Abu Na'ma, who actually started all of this movement and part of this movement. And without these voices, incredible voices, I mean, I would have been shunned aside and disappeared I would have became a ghost probably. But today they cannot ignore these voices. These people, obviously, I shamed them in public. They couldn't take it. They're busy with petty small things. And now they're all shocked that we have Donald Trump. But they paved the way for Donald Trump and the Islamophobia, racism, misogyny. That culture has been there and they've been bred and cultivated by major analysts in this country. So it doesn't define me what happened in that episode, but it defines its shameful stain on MSNBC forever.
That was Palestinian journalist and author Rula Jubriel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or within a two-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. If you miss a program on the WZBC Archive, and remember, it is only on this archive for 2 weeks, you can find any of our past broadcasts on our permanent archive, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive to hear any past broadcast, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All our past broadcasts are on the truthandjusticeradio.org archive. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be by anthropologist and author Jessica Winiger, who will discuss her controversial book, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.